Welcome, everyone, to another edition of SCRC's Let's Talk Caregiving. I'm your host, Roberto Velasquez, President and CEO of SCRC. And as always, I'm here with my co-host, Martha Rañon, our Executive Vice President.
Hey, Roberto.
Hey, Martha. Today's special guest is Dr. Daniel Sewell. He is a professor of clinical psychiatry and the Associate Vice Chair of Geriatric Psychiatry and Development, and the medical director at the Senior Behavioral Health Program over at UC San Diego. Welcome, Dr. Sewell.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, we are thrilled that you're joining us here today. We want to talk, of course, as always on our podcast, about family caregiving, but we want to talk about it from the LGBTQ perspective. Caregiving is universal. The needs of family caregivers are pretty consistent, to learn more about the diseases, connect to the resources and services, obtain guidance and emotional support from professionals, family, and friends, develop a care plan, implement self-care, right, Martha?
That's
and
right.
Get some respite, a break from caregiving. All of these types of needs are there. However, we know that for some populations, ethnic minority groups, and other underserved populations like the LGBT community, caregiving can be extra challenging for a number of different reasons, of course. And we can get into those in a second, but I wanted to let Martha jump in really quick.
Yes, I'm so glad that we have Dr. Sewell here today, because I really wanted to talk about a topic that I know in the past we've lightly touched on with presentations that we've done, and even the class that Roberta and I taught at San Diego State. And I know that, of course, caregiving is difficult no matter where you are and where you're coming from, what your background is. But this was an eye-opening experience for me, because we realized that with all the challenges that the LGBTQ community has gone through historically, throughout the years, that in all the gains that have been made and even the allies that have been developed and the awareness, there is still so much when it comes to the topic of caregiving and how those services are delivered. So I wanted to ask Dr. Sewell, what have you seen? What is your overall perspective of where we've been historically and where we are now, and maybe where we should be as it relates to caregiving with this particular group?
Great question, Marta. Thank you so much. So let me start with a positive note and acknowledge that things are better. Things are better than they have ever been. And we're so grateful for some of the institutional and cultural developments that have occurred over the past, couple decades that have really allowed members of these sexual and gender minority communities to feel that they are being treated fairly and equally along with all the other people in our world. But I think one important point we have to keep in mind when we talk about the LGBTQ community is that there are clearly cohort differences based on age. And so that's especially important, in that even though we have seen these wonderful strides in acceptance and equal treatment, individuals who now, based on age, are at increasing risk of developing dementia really lived a large part of their life during a previous era, where they were often and frequently victims of discrimination and mistreatment because of their gender or sexual identity status. And so they may be aware that things are better, but they still may have scars and wounds and psychological issues related to that earlier phase of their life that still influence them even now. And so how this translates into the present would be, for instance, because of previous experiences with mistreatment or discrimination, both the individual living with dementia and members of their caregiving team, if they're all part of the LGBT community, they may hesitate to get help. And that includes not just help from caregivers and caregiving organizations, but also help from medical providers. And they may hesitate because they fear that they won't be treated fairly, they won't be understood, and it won't be a really positive experience. But just to reiterate, there are cohort effects that we have to be sensitive to.
Right. And I appreciate you saying that, Dr. Sewell. I know that some of these cohorts, we have the oldest old who are from that Great Depression, World War II era, which are the older adults who are probably more likely dealing with the dementia, Alzheimer's types of illnesses. Then you have the now baby boomer cohort, who were, many of them were very active during the civil rights and protesting and getting rights for the gay and lesbian community. And they helped change, you know, the environment, yes, the atmosphere, the attitudes in our country. But they're so deep rooted, these prejudices and attitudes. And, you know, we have seen, like you said, some changes, especially in policy. Of course, one of the most significant in 2015, when the U.S. Supreme Court legalized gay marriage.
Yes.
And prior to that, I mean, this is just going back. This goes back to when we were teaching classes, Martha. I was just reviewing some of my notes, and it was just in the 70s where mental illness was attributed to being gay or lesbian.
It was pathologized. It was being
gay or
lesbian, and was viewed as illness rather than a variation of normal behavior.
Right. And it was finally declassified, but that was only in the 70s. So, you know, this is long history of discrimination.
I definitely want to make a point that as a social service agency, the focus over the work that we do is the family caregiver, and a large component is health and wellness. And as a service provider, we want to make sure that we also are serving with social services this community properly. And I know in our agency, we're trying our best, but I feel that there is still a long way to go with, you know, the nonprofits that are in communities to be able to address some of the needs, you know, housing, financial differences, obviously, you know, social services, but even religion. And I mean, there are just so many components that haven't been addressed truly, even recently.
Right.
On a positive note, I will say that from a caregiver program, one of the significant things that happened in the 2000s with the passage of the National Family Caregiver Support Program, which we as a Southern Caregiver Resource Center, we have the contract for the County of San Diego, it expanded the definition of caregiver, family caregiver, to be also include people that were not your family of origin, which is important because in the LGBT community, we know that there's a lot of reliance and development of relationships. It's families of choice. In fact, my friend has this beautiful plaque. Yeah, my friend has this beautiful plaque that I really love over his mantle. And it says, you know, family are the friends you choose. And because of that, we've been able to expand services to caregivers who are not necessarily of family origin or blood.
Yes, and that's been a wonderful development. And, you know, I want to also mention that there are regional differences in preparedness and cultural acceptance of these individuals. And we are lucky here in both California and San Diego, and lucky to be benefiting from organizations like SCRC, who are on the cutting edge of moving us forward in this area. But there are parts of the country where they are several steps behind us. And so it's really an important issue that we keep front and center. And I'm so grateful that you all have put this as a topic for one of the great podcasts that you guys create, because this type of experience continues to be greatly needed. You know, I've had the privilege of being a part of a number of recent research efforts in this arena. And one of the research efforts I undertook with a junior colleague of mine, a very gifted individual from the University of Indiana, Dustin Nowoski, we did a national survey looking at how well prepared Alzheimer's caregivers were. And we looked at both professional caregiving and then, you know, informal family caregivers. And unfortunately, what we found among the informal caregiving individuals, whether they were family, friends, or whoever, is that less than a third of them had had any type of cultural training and cultural sensitivity experience regarding the LGBT community. So I think that one of the things that we can do, and really the low-hanging fruit, is really educational efforts geared towards not even so much the credentialed caregivers like the physicians and nurses, but also looking really at the unlicensed family and volunteer caregivers and how have they been prepared to really care well for these people. And as we know, it's really the unlicensed caregivers that are doing most of that really up close and personal care. And if they haven't been culturally prepared, then it really doesn't go so well.
I completely agree. And I found that when I was putting together some educational presentations for the community, that was kind of the way we were going to start the conversation with individuals, because I know a lot of us, you know, step into the caregiving role because we love that person, we care for that person. But now with people living longer, and even though we're so connected by transportation and logistics, we're still very much a part in how we're able to connect with people and their needs. And so I definitely agree, Dr. Soul, that it starts with education and just a simple conversation. Hey, you know, let's check in with our neighbors. What could they possibly need and how can we connect them to services that are available?
The family caregivers, when you look at it and you talk about choice and family of choice, you're also going to experience some challenges and barriers to helping make decisions for your loved one that you're providing care and support to. And that's why it's so important for individuals who are not necessarily a family of origin, and even them as well, but to execute those powers of attorney, to get those medical consents, to get those documents in place, legal and financial documents in place, so that there's no question and you're not excluded from end of life decisions, or you're not excluded from capacity types of decisions for an individual where they will live, where they won't live. And that's incredibly important in your long-term care planning.
For sure. Well said, Roberto. I think that those are the steps that can be taken early on that will lead to better outcomes down the road when using those documents becomes essential in terms of the care that's needed for the individual living with dementia. You know, just to kind of reference the literature again, there was some recent qualitative research of LGBT caregivers of individuals living with dementia, and the caregivers said being gay and caring for a member of the LGBT community, their concerns were really loss of their LGBT identity, but also the cultural competence of those providing them with care. So just going back to that educational theme, I think we could go a long ways to helping these people feel safe and helping these people feel more comfortable accessing the resources that are there by providing this training and addressing that lack of cultural competence, or what we sometimes are now calling cultural humility. Because even in the absence of formal training, I think what's true is that if you approach each person as an individual without making assumptions and just value them and get to know them, that goes a long ways to really making sure they feel safe and well cared for.
So Dr. Soul, I wanted to also touch up on the issue that we're all very lucky when we have family caregivers or friends who we can rely on for caregiving and support. What happens when there is an individual that is very much isolated because maybe historically or within their family, they haven't had that support system. And so now they're at this point where they need care or they need support to care for someone else. And it's not that readily available. I know that, for example, in retirement communities, unless they actively promote, you know, we serve underserved communities, how do you know that it's that you're going to feel comfortable enough going into a facility where you're going to be treated with respect?
Right. That's such a great question. And the short answer is there's no easy way right now for someone needing services, whether they're outpatient or residential services, to know upfront who might really be trustworthy, who might really provide the culturally sensitive care that's necessary. My hope is that there'll someday be some type of program where skilled nursing, assisted living, home health care agencies can be accredited in some way, that they can demonstrate
a
level of cultural competence. And on their website or on their advertisements, there can be a little seal that says, our organization has met this minimum threshold of cultural competence, because I think that would really make it easier for the consumer to know what their choices would be, what the better choices might be.
Yeah, that's a really great idea. I know that from a Southern Caregiver Resource standpoint, we do a lot of training on cultural competency throughout the year across the board, whether you're an admin staff or a clinician providing services or a community educator. We do provide a lot of cultural competency training, and some of the special guests that we have come in from time to time are from the LGBT community who help us understand and become more culturally sensitive to the needs of family caregivers and older adults in the population. I know that one of the things that I really take pride in is the fact that we have, with Marta's help, we have developed programming that can be accessed at any time. So it really gears towards the working family caregiver, that sandwich generation, that younger adult, that Gen Xer who is now providing care to a parent, or the baby boomer who can't get out of the house because they're caring for somebody, you know, either their partner or parent as well. So we have wonderful resources over at Southern Caregiver Resource Center that people can access virtually, which is makes it really nice.
That is wonderful. That, like I say, we are very lucky here in San Diego to have resources just like that that make a difference in the lives of the people we care about. You know, this is not an insignificant group, although counting LGBTQ people continues to be quite difficult for all sorts of reasons that I won't digress on today. We know that there are about 2 to 4 million members of the LGBT community, and at least as recently as 2012, the Alzheimer's Association estimated that there were 350,000 members of the LGBT community currently living with dementia. So it's really not a small group. And I think that makes it even more important for us to be having this conversation. I know we're going to run short of time, but let me just say that, you know, some of the most heartbreaking experiences I've had as a provider have to do with issues about partners being separated because of cultural mm-hmm. incompetence and not being able to maintain that closeness at a time when that closeness may be more important than ever. I've also yes. had heartbreaking stories about people feeling like they had no choice but to go back into the closet after a really arduous journey of coming out of the closet. And then the last thing I want to share is because of the impact of AIDS and the impact on this particular older cohort, many of whom have lost dozens of members of their chosen family, they end mm-hmm. up then with such limited resources that they fall back on biological caregiving folks who may not have ever accepted them. And that is really a painful thing to witness, because now they need the care, they have no other choice, but they're being cared for by someone who doesn't even accept them. Boy, that's really a painful thing.
That is so difficult to even hear right now as you were talking and saying these things. I was getting, you know, just shivers, because I, you know, that's no way for anyone to live and age. And, you know, we're all going to age, and we want to age in the most positive and supportive way possible. And to actively deny someone this opportunity, it's not humane. And so I really want to say thank you for bringing light to this, Dr. Sewell.
Oh, well, thank you for choosing this topic.
Thank you. You know, I hope we continue to see positive strides in this whole caregiving arena and the LGBT community. I would love to continue talking more about this, but that's all the time we have for this segment of the Let's Talk Caregiving podcast. To hear more of our podcast, follow us on your favorite podcasting platforms or visit our website at scrc.care. I want to thank Martha for co-hosting another important discussion, and our guest, Daniel Sewell, Dr. Daniel Sewell, and our listeners for tuning in. If you're providing support to a loved one, you don't have to do this alone. Asking for help is not a sign of weakness, it's a sign of strength. To connect to our programs and services currently available through secure virtual platforms, visit our website at scrc.care or call us at 1-800-827-1008. If you're residing outside of San Diego and Imperial counties, visit caregivercalifornia.org and find the closest caregiver resource center to you in the state of California. As a nonprofit 501c3, SCRC relies on the generous donations of individuals and businesses in our community. To support our efforts and make a tax-deductible donation, please go to scrc.care and click on the Donate tab. And remember, SCRC is here for you,
caring for those who care for others.
Thank you.